everybody, and welcome to the GC On Demand podcast. My name is Eric Wright. I'm at Disco Posse on Twitter. I'm Disco Posse here in the Green Circle community. And I've got a very interesting and fun day ahead for us here. You know, when you say to someone, be honest with me about their opinion, it's often met with a pause and some kind of a carefully crafted reply. Today, I'm pleased to welcome someone special to the podcast who never has to be asked to be honest, because he just is. You know, he's the strong voice for a very important community of technologists, customers, and vendors alike. And more than anything, what I describe as his bombastic and unapologetic delivery makes him, you know, a true champion for the technology that he represents, the community he represents, and he's also just a blast to be around. You may know him as Cake Is Not a Lie on Twitter. And with that, I'd like to welcome Trevor Pott.
Good evening, victim. I mean, hello. So, it's nice to be here, and thank you very much for inviting me.
One of the first things I want to ask Trevor, and you've probably been asked this a dozen times or many, many more, what's the origin of the Twitter handle?
It's actually a bit of a response to the meme of the cake is a lie, which came from the video game Portal. One of the characters in the video game scrawls, the cake is a lie, the cake is a lie, the cake is a lie, over the walls as you're going through, because the evil computer AI is promising cake if you comply. And, you know, as you go through, keeps promising this cake. The thing is, at the end of the game, there actually is a cake. It's, you know, just laced with things that will kill you. So it's sort of a, I guess, a poke at this common theory that the cake was a lie and that you were not going to get the cake if you complied with the computer's demands. So you would get the cake, you just wouldn't like it.
Nice. So I guess we should start off mostly by, tell us give yourself a quick bio. Where do we find you online, and how do folks, find content that you're creating and such? And then we're going to get in and talk about a couple of neat subjects.
Well, probably the easiest place to find anything by me is to go to trevorpott.com. And click on the About button, mostly because that has the links to everything. I write for The Register, I write for TechTarget, I write for We Break Tech, and I say vile things all over Twitter. That's about all that there is for me.
So what I really wanted to talk with you about is there's an interesting spot. You know, We started quickly on the intro, before the intro, about this idea of SMB. You know, I come from a background in representing a lot of, medium businesses, small enterprise, and, super small, kind of three-host, two-host shops. And I like that you really, really talk a lot about that segment of the market. Plus, as a Canadian, you represent, an interesting, sort of cloud unfriendly group for a variety of regulatory reasons and a whole bunch of other stuff. But, and I talked about SMB as kind of this underrepresented thing, but I think that you mentioned something about that might not be the right way to describe it. So, but why is SMB seemingly, underrepresented?
Well, I think that this all boils down to what do people consider small and medium businesses? So one of the things to really bear in mind is that different geographic regions and different cultures have different ideas of what forms a small business, an enterprise, a mid-market company, etc. So in Canada, we actually do have government's, I guess, breakdowns for this. And in Canada, you're considered an enterprise if you're over 500 staff members. Now, 500 people would not constitute an enterprise in the U.S. If you have 1,000 people, then we can start talking. But you know, the United States is very much about these large enterprises. Now, one of the other things to bear in mind is it's not just the size of the company, it's how the companies behave. So Canada, Europe, some of Australia, these are areas, English-speaking countries, you know, for the most part, or countries that do business in English at least, that have small businesses and they operate largely as small businesses throughout their nations. But they are not small businesses in the same way that the United States has small businesses. Now, in the United States, virtually everything is capital intensive. By this, I mean businesses charge their customers a lot, and they in turn pay a lot for services, for technology, for staff, etc. Money flows through businesses in the United States in huge quantities. And it doesn't matter how small the business is. In the U.S., they just move a lot of money through the business. This doesn't happen in other areas. I mean, it does in some chunks of Europe, but not in most of Europe. It certainly doesn't happen like that in Canada. And, you know, a goodly chunk of Australia and New Zealand, it doesn't happen like that either. What you end up with in a lot of those areas is instead organizations that are very closely tied to their economy. So they live and die with how well the local economy is doing. So they're very affected by boom and bust issues. If the economy is doing very well, there's a reasonable amount of money that will end up going through those small businesses. And then they can do things like invest in computers, invest in equipment, machines to assist their manufacturing and whatnot. But when the bust hits, all the money dries up and they generally have trouble keeping their heads above water and paying their staff. So this is why things like cloud services, subscriptions, etc., do so much better in the U.S. than elsewhere, is because in the U.S. there's this constant flow of lots of money through the small, through even small businesses, that they can afford to essentially pay a subscription fee to stay in business.
And I think one of the things you really point out to a lot of folks, you know, is that idea of, you know, why not go cloud only? If you're a startup or a small business, and if you're running your own servers, and I always treat those very differently. Like a startup happens to be a small business, but a small business is not always a startup. A startup is meant to be a disruptor. It's meant to be something that's, you know, but small businesses are continuously operating businesses. They could be accountants, real estate offices, tons of other things, right? Like that's, people often get that mixed up when they talk about a 15-person company could be, you know, could be a 15-person.
Could be 200 years old.
That's right, exactly. And there's nothing wrong with being that size, because that's your business. It's your choice to maintain that size, and they can do very well at a 15-person.
Well, one other thing that I'd like to bring your attention to as a thought about small businesses. So food trucks. Might seem a little bit out there, I mean, especially as we're talking about technology, but actually food trucks are a great example of a small business. Now, a food truck could be one or two guys that own a single truck. It could be an entire fleet of food trucks or food carts all working together as part of a single company. But what we have is something that a lot of people wouldn't think about. Hey, what is the IT impact of running a food truck? But, you know, at the bare minimum, the guy probably has a smartphone with one of those square card readers, and somewhere he's going to have to be able to do his accounting, going to have to be able to do his taxes, I mean, and on and on and on. So he's probably invested in some software as a service applications for the financial side. He's probably got some subscriptions somewhere in order to handle his credit card transactions, his debit card transactions, that sort of thing. And, you know, if you start getting into some of the larger setups where you have 15, 20, 1500 food trucks all under the same company, then their IT investments can actually be pretty big. They could end up tracking individual food trucks, pulling in statistics, doing big data analytics on, you know, where is the best place to position these. I mean, it's actually kind of crazy how much IT small businesses, even the ones you would never expect, how much IT they actually have.
I'm forever going to use food truck IT as a new way to describe that kind of service model. I love it.
One of the things we were discussing just before this podcast started was the representation or not of small businesses. And you know, just to get back to that for a second, I think this really does depend on how you define the small business. There is a mid-market as well that I think is actually the bit that is truly underrepresented. And the small business and the mid-market is something that I really separate. And I separate this mostly by IT behavior. Small businesses are not particularly automated, at least not yet. They're not capable of spending an awful lot on capital expenditures. They're generally not particularly capable of spending too much on SaaS. So they rely on lesser IT. It's not particularly good. It's not particularly tested. It's not as redundant or as resilient. And so as such, it's actually less efficient. They end up having to make more backups more often, and those backups aren't as up to date and they aren't as continuous and all the rest of that. And you know, if a desktop fails, then a small business won't just push a button and deploy it all out from the Pixie server. They're going to probably be rebuilding that thing by hand. Now, when you get into the mid-market, which in my experience is around 250 users, that changes. And mid-market companies are obsessed with appliances. They have the same number of IT staff as small businesses, but those IT staff just do not have the time to run around with their hair on fire all the time. So they buy appliances for everything, and they're obsessed with appliances. And I think you start moving into the enterprise when you start leaving the appliances behind and you start building more bespoke solutions again. But in this case, you're now building bespoke solutions for 1,000 users or 10,000 users or what have you. And that's where the real money comes in, because those solutions have to be 24/7 up. They have to, you know, respond to any issue. If there is an outage, you have to be able to recover from it right away. In a small business, if the IT goes out, you're not totally screwed if your IT is down for a day or two. If your IT is down for a day or two in an enterprise, you could be losing millions.
Yeah, you're gonna end up in the paper,
or
you're gonna end up on the register, right?
And, well, exactly. And now with a mid-market company, your IT might or might not get you into that kind of trouble if it's down for a couple of days, but you can't afford to solve the solution by throwing manpower at it. So you solve the solution by throwing appliances at it. And I think these are really three distinct groups. And it's typically the mid-market that's the underrepresented one. There's all sorts of crappy IT available for small businesses. With small businesses, they're generally okay with being 10 years out of date. That's the thing a lot of people don't get, is the IT that enterprises were using 10 years ago is just fine for small businesses today.
Yeah, it's kind of like there's all these cars that come back that are 4 years old off lease. And guess what? They don't go to the junkyard, right? They go to a massive pool of customers who are ready to buy an 80,000 kilometer car. And they plan to drive that thing until it's 160 or until it dies. And they're completely comfortable with that. And that same cycle happens in IT. You get folks that buy servers off eBay, or even just, you know, the lower end servers, and they ride it out until that thing smokes.
Well,
it's
not just like the physical hardware. I mean, very few small businesses are, for example, going on to eBay and buying NetApp equipment from 10 years ago.
Right.
But if you are buying equipment new from a small business-focused vendor, that what they are essentially providing is a storage solution that is NetApp from 10 years ago or EMC from 10 years ago or something, it doesn't matter to a small business. They'll just, okay, so it's not the latest, greatest. It's not the, the bleeding edge stuff. It doesn't give them a competitive disadvantage to use technology that is that dated. Whereas, if you get into the mid-market, this is where there's that huge, huge demand for being up-to-date, because they really have to compete with enterprises. And if they are behind, then they're going to notice it, and they're going to be at a serious competitive disadvantage. But they just don't have the IT staff levels to go up against, a full-bore enterprise solution. So that's where they need those appliances. And that's where it comes in fits and starts. You'll get a really big wave of appliance-based solutions for the mid-market, and then it'll stagnate for 10 years. And then you'll get another big wave of solutions that are as appliances.
So one of the things that I think is important to it, and you can maybe confirm it or talk more about it, the rise of services and support as a major part of the offering. A lot of the enterprise target, they wrap services into it because it's usually implementation, because it's a big deal, it's a ton of hardware, it's a whole lot of complex setup. But the service package company, so if I buy three nodes of something, and I know that I'm going to be I'm relying on them, do you think this is going to be the differentiator for a lot of companies in that mid-market space?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, just look at scale computing. They exist because they provide what I have termed the data center butler, but is essentially just a white glove support offering from them. You can get a cheaper hyper-converged solution that does more or less the same thing from Cloud Weavers. They have an offering called Node Weaver. It can be, half the price of scale computing. But scale, especially in North America, they have support that Cloud Weavers cannot currently match, although Cloud Weavers could probably give them a run in Europe. And this, in turn, has set, scale apart from some of their larger competitors as well, who price things a little bit higher or, have their support offerings go entirely through the channel. It's what's made them a successful business. And I think that they're just one example amongst many of this, where it is that support offering that is really differentiating vendors at this point. I think the other thing, and it's really quite a shame that Nutanix marketing was so on the ball that they stole the term, but the concept of invisible infrastructure is really at the center of this discussion. We have reached the point for most businesses that IT is good enough, that you can do what you need to do with the appliances of the day. And it's going to be another 10, 15 years before we really need another wave of appliances to solve another round of IT problems. I think for servers, for infrastructure, for that sort of thing, we are where CPUs were in 2004 or 2006, where you just stop caring about the next version. And that means that as these appliances get good enough, they become capable enough to do what we need them to do, it's the service and support that matters. Upgrading through the versions as they come, making sure the security patches don't break anything, that sort of thing. Because we're going to move away from needing piles of specialist sysadmins just to keep the lights on, and start having sysadmins that care about what's inside your VMs. It's what you can do with your infrastructure that matters, not what the infrastructure is.
So the idea of less knob turning and getting back to like the the reason, like, we're brought in to be engineers, not to engineer diverse, exotic, you know, hardware and software solutions. We're here to meet business needs, right?
Well, pretty much. I mean, you don't need NASA and a Saturn V to commute to work.
It would make it fast, though.
Yes. Yes, it would. But I don't think most people care. And I think that's the thing, is that once you have halfway decent infrastructure and something like VM Turbo to manipulate it in an automated fashion, and you have some decent analytics on the side, preferably some predictive analytics to tell you when things are about to fail. Does it matter? I mean, do you need to obsess about what storage you're putting in there or who's selling you your server or whatnot? Do you even see that stuff anymore? Do you crack open your individual nodes and go mucking about the guts anymore?
Yeah, we used to nerd out like hardcore on that stuff. You would get a server and you would open it up and you'd look at all the bits, you'd put it together. Now you get it built by your VAR because you don't want to care, or you buy it as an appliance. Like I said, you slide it into the rack, you plug in two Ethernet cables, and life is good, right?
Yeah, I mean, I run entire data centers that I've never physically seen. There's some cable monkey on site, or, you know, we hire some cable monkey to come in for the day, and, you know, they will hook everything up and I can access things remotely, load up an operating system remotely. You know, as long as I have a bridgehead into your system, into your data center somewhere, I can handle the rest of it, manipulate the entire data center from across the world.
So do you see the change in like, I used to call it the rise of the generalist, right? The idea that you have to now know about a little about storage, a little about networking, a little about compute, a little about applications, and it's kind of moving further up the stack as far as getting closer to the apps. And you know, you've been at this for a few years. Do you really see the evolution across the board of folks that are, you can no longer just be like, I'm the storage person and I'm awesome at storage, so I'm good for 20 years. Like, I just don't think that exists anymore.
Well, yes and no. So that's an interesting question. There will always need to be a few specialists, but I think the number of businesses that can be supported by a single specialist is changing. You might need some storage specialists in your vendors or in your VARs or, you know, whoever is providing support for multiple organizations. But you no longer have a situation where, for infrastructure at least, every organization needs a cloud of their own specialists. And I think it's very important to draw the distinction there for infrastructure. You no longer, as an individual, need to know how to fix your own car. You can just drive the car into, you know, the local garage, and that local garage will solve your car, and the, you know, they'll fix cars for dozens of businesses. And I mean, maybe if you are the size of a city and you have a fleet of buses, do you keep your own mechanics online? But for the most part, no. You don't need to know how to fix a car. And I mean, hey, I have been stuck on highways in other countries, and all I had to do was dial up the local motor association, and tow truck shows up, and, you know, problem solved. That's where we got with cars. That's where we're going with computer infrastructure. But the flip side to that is that it is now the rise of the developer. Small businesses, as small as 5 people, are starting to hire developers. In the 90s, we would have shade tree computer nerds working essentially as operations guys.
Yeah.
They would be installing Windows, they would be building servers, etc. That's dead. It's gone. Get over it. Now it's the developer. Even small businesses need custom software to make their businesses work, because shelfware doesn't adapt to the individual needs of individual businesses. It doesn't adapt to the business process refinements that companies want to make in order to stay competitive, in order to make those business processes work and be integrated with the computer systems, be automated, be integrated with their suppliers and vendors and all the rest of that, they need an in-house developer. And that's where the new specialists are coming from, is specialist developers working with generalist developers who are working with a generalist ops guy.
And I think that talks about the skill set that we need to get as technologists, that we need to lean in further and understand the business, and not, like, we're technologists by nature, but without having something to map to, it can no longer be all about the technology. The commoditization is not about making it cheaper. It's about making it seemingly generic, you know, abstracting it so that we can get further up the stack. Is that kind of a good way to represent it?
Well, I think so. And I think that one of the best ways to really wrap your mind around it is to consider smartphones. Nobody other than the "I keep large quantities of urine in jars" class nerds cares about smartphones. Even most technologists just do not care what is inside their smartphone. Their smartphone goes fast enough or it doesn't. It is patched on a regular basis and thus not vulnerable to too many security flaws, or it's not. This is about the extent to which we care about our phones. You know, the odd nerd might care a little bit about the camera, but let's face it, they're kind of all crap. Nobody cares what CPU is in your phone, and so on and so forth. And yet, we all use them. We carry these smartphones everywhere. But what we care about is apps on the phone, the configuration, the data that we put on the phone. But we stop caring about the device. And what I'm trying to say, I guess, is that we're getting there to a certain extent with entire data centers, not just servers, not just UPSs, but the whole thing.
And I think it's a neat kind of renaissance, you know, that we're walking into, where we've got, you know, some of the previous generation of technologists that I find are, we've got an interesting thing to bring, where you've got this, you know, broad experience, and you bring it into now a development focused market. What do you think, if you were new, if you're 20 years old, you're 19, you're in college, what do you think, if you think, I'm going to become a systems admin, I'm going to become a developer, like, what, if you were 19-year-old Trevor right now, what would you start learning?
Well, first of all, if I could go back and do it all again, I would never have gone into computers, because I hate computers. I got into computers for entirely the wrong reasons. But actually, what I would, if I were to give a recommendation to anybody, it would be, don't go into computers. Don't go into systems administration. Don't go into development, any of that. We are in the process of a major realignment of this entire sector, and along with it is coming some pretty dramatic downwards wage pressure. You're maybe going to be able to find a living in information security for a while, mostly because we suck at it, but that's counterbalanced by the fact that nobody actually wants to spend money on information security, and every nerd on the planet is trying to get into information security because it's seen as the only safe space. If you wanted to make a living working with technology, you would walk away from technology and start getting into where technology is applied. So by this, I'm talking about medicine, genetics especially, machine learning, even things like city planning and logistics, shipping. These are areas where if you know a reasonable amount about technology, you can transform the entire disciplines through the application of technology. But the way that you are going to be able to do that is not to become a technologist and then seek to disrupt those areas. It is to learn how those areas work and then become a technologist. Find out where the technology needs to be applied and then go learn what the technology that exists can do for you. And I think that's a way of thinking that a lot of technologists find anathema. They would rather learn about the technology first and then go, okay, so how can I then change the world using my technology?
Yeah,
but now the technology is everywhere. So, you need domain-specific knowledge to make use of technology now.
Right. Yeah, I think that's always been an interesting thing where we've got people that really are amazing specialists, but yet they have trouble seeing how it's getting applied. And it's different. Right? Running a great technology is not necessarily a great technology business. And we've seen it dozens of times. Company with really cool software, hardware, whatever it is, and it just goes south because they just don't have a market because they built something really cool. Or even it gets bought up by another company, a big player, and then it just kind of disappears and then shows up 7 years later in some other product that they've put into their portfolio. It's really interesting.
Well, I think probably the biggest lesson that technologists as a whole have yet to learn is the era of technology for technology's sake is over. We, for 30 years, could get away making good livings, building a slightly better mousetrap, a slightly faster car. We could get away with fetishizing our technology to the point that what we did was create more and more technology just to keep our existing technology going. But we've more or less hit the end of that. Now we have to actually do something useful with that technology outside the domain of supporting technology in and of itself. And that is where I think a lot of people have problems who have worked in IT for a long time. And some people like to say this is the learn what the business does. But it's more than that. You need to either have the domain-specific knowledge about what the business does yourself, which is hard because you'd have to become an expert in a whole other field, or you have to learn to play nice with others. And just as we are, as technologists, facing the evaporation of a lot of our jobs due to automation, due to technology, to go into some other area and say, by the way, what I as a technologist want to do in order to preserve my job is to reduce your entire department's headcount to about 25% by automating it, you're going to find some resistance.
Understandably, right? So the interesting thing I always like to ask folks is what's the must-read book you've got? What are great resources that you use yourself and that you kind of would recommend to folks who are, whatever it is, getting through their day-to-day, SMB, mid-market, whatever. What's the book that you say, what's the favorite book on Trevor's bookshelf, and what are other great places for people to go?
Well, that's kind of interesting. I've thought about this a lot, and the thing is that I don't really have a book that I find particularly useful. What I have found to be far more useful is to go find the list of the top VMware-based bloggers and read the individual blogs, listen to the podcasts, etc., from the virtualization community. And the reason I say this is because it's such a diverse community with so many different viewpoints that right now you have some of the smartest people on the planet trying to figure out how to deal with the changes to IT, the changes to our society and culture that are occurring. And everybody's got a different take. For everything that I've said in this podcast, there are 5 other viewpoints that will disagree with me in some or all ways. And those need to be read and heard and considered. And that is, I think, the most important thing that we as technologists can do.
Yeah, I think that goes to part of, you know, I always tell people, it's not that you make the decision, you know, you don't have to, the decision is about the criteria you use to make the decision. It's less about the decision, because decisions are right and wrong. They're like Schrodinger's cat. It's always in a state of complete wrongness, complete rightness, and we just have to make it work. But what's the criteria you use to make that decision? And that's about gathering information, finding folks that are, you know, in your predicament and that are walking the journey with you, right? And I love the top V bloggers. I love like Eric Siebert's stuff. That's a great, great resource. And it's funny to see. Yeah, it was early VMware bloggers, all of them. And now we're seeing some Hyper-V stuff come up. And I remember going in there as my first year was as a PowerShell blogger. And now all of a sudden you're seeing more, you know, more Hyper-V, some AWS stuff. You're seeing containers, you're seeing OpenStack, KVM, all over the place. It's that evolution is happening, and we're walking through it as a journey all together. It's exciting. I love being a part of it.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I get to work with some vendors on some of this stuff, and I get to watch as the vendors make some of these realizations and evolve as well. One of my favorite vendors at the moment is Catalogic. As I'm working with them, and I'm realizing or helping them to realize that the product that they built is not quite what they thought, and actually it's not just a little bit of data protection or copy data management, which it, I mean, certainly is, but the specific way that they've put it together also actually makes DevOps usable for those companies that are moving towards it, and it makes them, I guess, more palatable. I mean, a lot of the ways when you start talking about things like DevOps, people start talking about massive culture changes and huge shifts in how you do things right away. And you know, Catalogic, when I looked at what they had, I was like, well, but this is that baby step. It's that first step that gets you down that path, and you know, you can keep using this pretty much the whole way through. But they had never thought of it that way. They'd never thought of the developer side of it, and had been focused entirely on the operations side. And once they did, they started going, wow, okay, let's reach out to the developer community and see what they have to say and see how this would help for them. And it changed everything for them. And that's the really fun part about all of this is that you can get these completely different viewpoints and they can change how you do everything.
It goes to that whole thing of, you know, I always tell vendors, if you tell me that I'm using it wrong, no, you haven't understood how people can use your software or hardware, right? That's what it is. And I love that they've done it. They've recognized, like, wow, there's a different use case in here. Let's latch onto it. Let's embrace it. You know, some would call it a pivot. Some would call it whatever. You know, Docker's a classic story of that, right? They're developing a PaaS. They need a container environment to develop the PaaS. The container environment's better than the PaaS. Let's become a container platform. Yeah. We see it with hardware, with other folks all the time. And I love that's the, like, recognize it, listen to your customers, and run with it. Like, that's cool. Yeah, you've done a lot of really cool stuff with them.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I really like about working with vendors is that the good ones do exactly what you're talking about. They listen to their customers, and they listen to the community, and they end up realizing that sometimes they have created a product which can be used in more ways than they originally imagined, and that makes them a lot more valuable. I mean, unfortunately, there are a lot of bad vendors that don't listen, but I guess this goes back to that whole go read these blogs from various other people. Seek out opinions and ideas, especially those that disagree with you. Not just so that you can sit there and make yourself mad on the internet, but because if you can learn why they disagree with you and how they came to that belief or understanding, you might open your mind up to an entirely different way of thinking and an entirely different approach to the problems that you are facing.
I love it. Well, we're wrapping up on time, and you know, Trevor, you've brought some really, really great stuff here today from the community. You know, someone who's been a reader of yours a long time and likes to follow along your journey. Thank you for being unabashedly honest about things. Where do folks find you? And again, remember, it is cake is not a lie, but it's cake is underscore not underscore a lie. I've misplaced the underscores a couple times early on when I first learned, started reading your stuff, and I kept like, what was Trevor's handle again? But so again, you know, where do we find you online?
The best place is probably going to be trevorpot.com, and just click on the About Trevor button, and it has links to everything.
And I know there's lots of folks that are listening to both of us going, they say about funny because they're Canadian.
No doo to boot it, eh?
That's right. That's right. Excellent. Well, again, for folks who want to learn more about Trevor, of course, go to trevorpot.com. That's two T's in the pot. He is cake is underscore not underscore a lie on Twitter. Trevor, it's been great to be here. If anybody wants to keep the conversation going, you can do so in the Green Circle. Go to greencircle.vmturbo.com. You can go to gcondemand.io, which is where we find all of the listings of our episodes. And yeah, hopefully Trevor will have you on again. And I know there's so much more we could talk about, but you know, in 40-minute chunks, we can only do so much. So again, thanks for coming on today, and we'll hope to see you again at a conference or other community item very, very soon.
All right. Thank you very much for having me.